Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Some crimes are so heartbreaking or shocking that they change laws, change society, or even earn the label crime of the century. But the stories that made headlines in decades past aren't necessarily remembered today. I'm Amber Hunt, a journalist and author, and in each episode of this show, I'll examine a case that's maybe lesser known today, but was huge when it happened. This is Crimes of the Centuries. The Texas Death Chamber, where inmates convicted of particularly egregious crimes breathe their last, is smaller than you think. It's kept as a sterile environment, as if it were a surgical suite. It's painted a vivid shale of teal. The executioner, whoever he or she is, stays out of sight behind a one-way piece of glass. The chamber is located inside the state's oldest prison in Huntsville, Texas. Built in 1849, it's known by inmates and townies as the Walls Unit because of its surrounding 15-foot-high red brick walls that separate it from the rest of the small town's homes and its nearby neighbor, Sam Houston State University. It was built back when the city was basically two streets and a barber shop, but it's now literally part of a nice neighborhood, like one you'd see anywhere. Except this one has rifle-bearing guards positioned on parapets overlooking it. Inside, some of the bars are still a highly polished brass. Clyde Barrow once lived within its confines, so did serial killer Henry Lee Lucas. In the 1970s, it housed TV bounty hunter-to-be Dwayne Dog Chapman. It's here, at the Walls, where Texas has put to death nearly 600 individuals since the death penalty was reinstated in 1976. Prior to that temporary stoppage last century, the state had executed 755 others in the electric chair. This makes Texas the state with the highest number of executions of convicted felons in the United States. Some Texans are proud of this, some aren't. Regardless, what all this means is that the threat of the death penalty in Texas is not an idle one. If you did the crime the state has duly gone to the trouble of convicting you of, and if that crime was a capital murder that involved intentional killing, coupled with specific aggravating circumstances that include things like kidnapping or arson or death of a child or a cop, there's a good chance that your last view on this earth will be of vivid teal walls. These days, you won't be offered a last meal of your choice. A chaplain might not be allowed to stand by you. No court or duly elected Texas governor is likely to save you. There will be a few witnesses to your death, all behind glass. They are not all there to mourn you. Is it an irretrievable and irreversible sentence? Of course, that's the point. Is it cruel? Some think so. Unusual? I don't know how to measure that. But on February 17th, 2004, Cameron Todd Willingham sat ready to die in this room, accused of purposefully killing his three young daughters by setting his house on fire. He had been waiting for this day for 12 years. And in those 12 years since his conviction, the science of fire forensics had grown exponentially more sophisticated and its experts more vocal about its past abuse. Ever since Willingham's capital murder conviction, evidence had been steadily mounting that he was an innocent man. The question was, would anyone listen?
Crimes
Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Quince. You know, I've realized something recently. The bar for a good night's sleep is actually pretty low until you upgrade your bedding.
Yeah, once it's better, you notice immediately.
We've had Quince sheets for a while now, and it's one of those things where you don't think it'll make a huge difference, and then it does. They're just really soft, really comfortable, and feel a little more substantial than what we had before. And they've got options depending on what you like.
And it doesn't feel overpriced. It feels like luxury bedding, but it's priced way lower than you'd expect, like 50 to 80% less than similar brands, because Quince cuts out the middleman and works directly with the manufacturer.
So you're paying for the materials, not the markup.
Refresh your everyday with luxury you'll actually use. Head to quince.com/centuries for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/centuries for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/centuries.
The story of Cameron Todd Willingham, who went by his middle name, starts not in Texas, but in Ardmore, Oklahoma in 1968, with a mother who walked away and a father who, reluctantly, did not. Willingham's single mother abandoned him in California when he wasn't even a year old. She had other mouths to feed, all from different fathers, and she may have realized that Todd's father would take him in if she quit her claim to him. She guessed right. His father and stepmother raised him from the age of 13 months on. He often fought with his father, who took no particular liking to him, giving him too little guidance and too many obstacles to climb over successfully. His stepmother claimed to have loved him dearly. By several accounts, Todd was just 11 years old when he started huffing paint to escape whatever reality he was living. He was not yet in junior high. In his teen years, he racked up minor offenses for shoplifting and petty theft. Some would later say he was a violent kid, but no authority he brushed up against during those early years remembers it that way. Bebe Bridges, who served as a special judge in the District Court of Carter County, Oklahoma, explained in a PBS Frontline episode called Death by Fire.
I put him in jail, I think, on his 18th birthday because he had screwed up again. And I said, I have tried to save your ass, and now I'm going to put your ass in jail so you can't enjoy your 18th birthday. You're going to go to jail for the weekend or whatever it was. I don't remember the details. He wasn't a sociopath. He wasn't a psychopath. He did stupid crap like steal bikes.
Todd had dropped out of high school in the 10th grade. Anytime he was presented with a chance to better himself, he seemed to intentionally dodge it. He wasn't much interested in figuring out a career path in life. He was too busy listening to the heavy metal music he loved and embracing the whole cultural zeitgeist of the genre epitomized by his favorite band, Iron Maiden. He was just 13 when the British band came out with its sophomore album, Killers. That was followed by 1982's The Number of the Beast. Later, his love for Iron Maiden's music would be linked to his alleged crime, complete with the public's phobic insistence that the band was shoveling Satanism into teenagers. If that were so, God save Britannia. The Number of the Beast LP went on to be voted Best British Album of the last 60 years as part of the late Queen's Diamond Jubilee celebration in 2012. It is, says Wikipedia, quote, among the most popular heavy metal albums of all time, having sold almost 20 million copies worldwide, end quote. In short, he was a pretty typical kid, especially among those struggling to figure out where they fit. He met his future wife, Stacy, when she was 17. By the time he was 22, the pair had three children whom the unemployed auto mechanic could not support. Stacy's own backstory was deeply troubled, though in different ways than Todd's. Her father strangled her mother to death when Stacy was just four. Her childhood afterward was chaotic at best, as you can imagine. As she inched toward adulthood, she desperately wanted stability, but had no idea how to get it. Todd seemed a possible path, though not a healthy one. She later said Todd repeatedly physically abused her and that she stayed with him because she believed he would change. In 1990, the still unmarried couple moved to Corsicana, Texas, to be closer to her brother, who had offered her a job waitressing. Corsicana is a small town, population now just 25,000, a few thousand bigger than it was in 1990. It sits about an hour southeast of Dallas. It has two claims to fame. It's the birthplace of Wolf Brand Chili and of Collins Street Bakery, which annually sells and mails millions of pounds of its famous fruitcake across the world. Small aside, journalist Amy Wilson insists you are not officially a Texan if you haven't been served that fruitcake during at least a dozen Christmas seasons. But back to Corsicana, where most of Todd and Stacy's neighbors were solid, working-class people who looked out for one another. They would be the ones to tell police about the abuse they had heard coming from the house. The cops were called on a few occasions to referee. Neighbors would also relay that Todd spent a bit too much time in bed with the older woman across the street. Despite all of this, in the fall of 1991, Todd and Stacy were married. It looked as if Todd was making Stacy and their children, 2-year-old Amber and 1-year-old baby twins, Carmen and Cameron, his top priorities. But it didn't last. The wedding band didn't put an end to Todd's carrying on with the neighbor lady. His heavy drinking and late-night partying down at the corner bar didn't stop either. Nor did his regular beatings of Stacy. While Stacy waited tables, Todd stayed home to watch the girls. This was not a feminist forward arrangement. Todd was, as his half-brother would later say, bored, lazy, and a poor provider. The three little girls shared a single room. The house was warmed by space heaters that used open flame behind grates. One such heater was in the girls' bedroom. Otherwise, the house was sparsely furnished. The kitchen did not have a stove, so the family made meals with the help of a 2-burner hot plate, a deep fat fryer, and a microwave that tended to give off concerning popping noises when in use. On the Monday morning of December 23, 1991, anxious to give her children a nice Christmas, Stacy left the house around 9 a.m. to be first in line at the Salvation Army to pick up presents. She left her husband asleep in their bedroom and Amber playing quietly. Todd would later say the twins woke him up crying, so he got up to give them bottles. He said he then took them from their crib and placed them on the floor to play. Then he returned to the bedroom where he went back to sleep. The next thing he would remember was the 2-year-old screaming.
The little girls cried, "Daddy, Daddy." When I woke up, the whole house was in smoke.
A little after 10 a.m., when Diane Barbie was watching The Price is Right on TV, her young daughters went out the back door to play on their patio. They came running in to tell her they saw smoke coming out of the neighbor's house.
I run to the front and out the door, and that's when I seen Todd at his front door, and he started screaming, "My babies, oh, my babies are burning."
Todd was wearing pants but no shoes. He yelled for Barbie to call 911. Todd said he ran back into the house to rescue his girls, that he'd crawled on the floor, that his hair caught on fire, that he felt what he thought was an arm, but it was just a doll, that he was blocked by the smoke and flames and, knowing it was futile now, reluctantly turned back. Neighbors had gathered, and a few would remember Todd going around the house to where the children's room's windows were, breaking one. The heat and flames exploded out and drove him back. When the fire trucks arrived, Bervin Smith remembers seeing Todd.
And I grabbed him. I said, "Is there anybody in the house?" He said, "Yes, my twins are in that room right there." Well, I went in the front door, and I went to the left, and that's as far as I could get. It was completely engulfed in fire.
Ron Franks, another firefighter, did make it in. He entered what would later be determined to be the primary bedroom and found Amber on the floor. Scooping her limp body up, he exited the still burning house and handed her to someone who raced with her to the hospital, where she was confirmed dead. The blaze, which had consumed most of the interior of the house, was eventually tamed by water hose-wielding Corsicana fire crews. Assistant Fire Chief Douglas Fogg was the first to enter the structure and found the two other little girls on the floor near their bed. They, like Amber, had died from smoke inhalation, though they were also badly burned. The coroner would say those injuries likely happened after they had already succumbed. The police found Stacy at the Salvation Army, where she was still shopping for Christmas gifts, and told her that her children were no more. It didn't take long for fire and police authorities to start asking questions about what 23-year-old Todd had actually done that morning. His own rather innocuous injuries, he had minor burns on his shoulders and his hair had been singed, didn't line up with his story of having rushed back into the burning house to rescue his children. Meanwhile, the entire community grieved with the young couple. Vicky Prater, a local bar owner, decided to hold a fundraiser to help the family pay the burial expenses for their children. She organized a dart tournament for Wednesday night, and as Vicky tells it, Todd got too involved in the fun. It seemed to everyone in attendance that a man who had just lost his three children to fire shouldn't be drinking beer, laughing, and backslapping his throwing competition. Vicky was appalled that he had asked if he could take home a new set of darts she had bought and then gleefully pocketed the cash she'd collected. After that night, the investigation into the fire as arson began in earnest. The little girls were buried the day after Christmas. Neighbors who had previously been nothing but sympathetic toward Todd and Stacy shifted their stories ever so slightly now, telling investigators that they had previously assumed that Todd might kill Stacy, but they had not figured him for a child murderer. They reframed his actions that day, making it appear as if they had questioned his motives all along. Wanting to get this absolutely right, Assistant Chief Fogg, a certified arson investigator, invited Manuel Vasquez, the deputy fire marshal from the state fire marshal's office, to join him in going back into the house. It was time to see where the fire had started and why. When asked permission to enter the abode, the Willinghams readily agreed. Todd said he wanted to know why his girls had died. He seemed eager to find something to blame. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Home Chef. You know that moment around 6 p.m. where you're suddenly starving and you realize there's nothing ready to eat?
That's when bad decisions happen.
Not if you have Home Chef in the fridge. When we do, it means a plan is in place before things go off the rails.
And it's food we actually want to eat. Home Chef sends fresh ingredients with recipes that are easy to follow and meals actually turn out good. No long shopping lists, no complicated prep, and cleanup is pretty minimal, which matters more than I'd like to admit.
Also, depending on the day, we can go easier. They've got 30-minute meals, oven-ready trays, even quick microwave lunches if you just need something fast.
Home Chef is rated number one by users of other meal kits for quality, convenience, value, taste, and recipe ease. And it helps with the budget, too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries.
Which adds up quickly. For a limited time, Home Chef is offering my listeners 50% off and free shipping for your first box, plus free dessert for life. Go to homechef.com/COTC. That's homechef.com/COTC for 50% off your first box and free dessert for life. Homechef.com/COTC. Must be an active subscriber to receive free dessert. Jimmy Hensley was the police officer put in charge of the fire investigation. It was his first arson case. What he lacked in experience, his fire department counterparts made up for in abundance. Assistant Fire Chief Douglas Fogg had worked 20 years in the field. State Fire Marshal Manuel Vasquez claimed to have investigated 1,200 to 1,500 fires in his 15 years of doing the job, adding that most of those he'd looked into were indeed the result of arson. He had testified in at least 25 cases, most in the service of the prosecution. The two fire investigators walked through the charred remains at 1213 West 11th Street and quickly began to notice things, like the deep scorching on the base of the walls, like the peculiar patterns that had been made by the fire that looked suspiciously like puddles of accelerant had settled there before igniting, as if someone had poured liquid fuel onto the floor to hasten its flashpoint and intensify its burn. They saw where the aluminum stripping around the threshold had melted. They took copious notes. The investigators also took more than a dozen samples throughout the house to test for the presence of accelerants. All came back negative, except for a sample taken from the front porch. In the August 31, 2009 issue of The New Yorker, journalist David Gran wrote a story about the case. Entitled Trial by Fire, he described the visible damage when the investigators went looking. Here's an excerpt. Quote, "The fire had burned through layers of carpeting and tile and plywood floor. Moreover, the metal springs under the children's beds had turned white, a sign that intense heat had radiated beneath them. Seeing that the floor had some of the deepest burns, Vasquez deduced that it had been hotter than the ceiling, which, given that heat rises, was, in his words, not normal." By now, both investigators had a clear vision of what had happened. Someone had poured liquid accelerant throughout the children's room, even under their beds, then poured some more along the adjoining hallway and out the front door, creating a fire barrier that prevented anyone from escaping. Similarly, a prosecutor later suggested, the refrigerator in the kitchen had been moved to block the back door exit. The house, in short, had been deliberately transformed into a death trap. End quote. In the joint report they filed, the two fire investigators indicated that they found 20 instances that proved the fire was intentionally set. The trace accelerant on the porch featured largely in their conclusions. Why someone would have intentionally set the fire, the motive, was unclear. While it was true that the girls each had $5,000 of life insurance, gifts from their maternal great-grandfather, Todd and Stacy were not the beneficiaries. The great-grandfather was. Could the motive have been as simple as Todd's desire to live a more carefree life, free from parenting obligations? The police and the prosecutorial team of Navarro County must have thought so, as they arrested him, SWAT style, 2 weeks after the fire as Todd and Stacy were driving through town. The county assigned two local lawyers to defend him. Both advised Todd, pre-trial, to plead guilty to the crime in exchange for a life sentence, thus sparing him the possibility of execution. Todd refused, a risky gamble considering the state had experts on their side that Todd's lawyers either wouldn't or couldn't bother to counter. Todd wanted to testify in his own defense, but he was talked out of that as well. Truth was, his attorneys saw no point. This is David Martin, one of his assigned attorneys, a former state trooper.
You know, I've been criticized by some because I've said that, of course, I thought he was guilty. How stupid would you be, how incompetent would you be as a defense attorney if you just went in and swallowed the story the defendant gave you? The real fact of the matter is that Willingham was guilty. He wasn't innocent. He really set that fire and killed those kids.
That's who Todd had in his corner. The trial began in August 1992. John Jackson, the prosecutor in charge of the bulk of the trial, made sure the jury heard Hensley, Vasquez, and Fogg detail what they had seen and explain why they had drawn the conclusions they had. They showed pictures that illustrated their 20 instances of proof that accelerant had been used and maps to show the path of the fire as it traveled through the house. They remarked upon finding devil worship artwork in the primary bedroom, which they thought might be indicative of some kind of Satanism at play. And to be clear, the devil artworks were the aforementioned Iron Maiden album covers and posters that the young father hung in his bedroom. He also had skull tattoos inked on his arms. The investigators saw this all as quite sinister. In fact, the pattern of burn in the children's room? Well, that just might have been in the shape of a pentagram. This all played quite badly in God-fearing Corsicana. Martin might have thought that Todd was guilty, but he forever maintained that he did what he could, given that the arson expert the defense had hired had agreed with the prosecutorial position that it was a set fire. Here he is in Incendiary, a 2011 documentary on the case made by Steve Mims and Joe Bailey Jr. for Yokel Productions.
Yes, we were arguing that it wasn't arson, that it was accidental. But we didn't have any expert testimony about that. And that's why my recollection is that our cross-examination of Fogg and Vasquez was a lot about all the accidental things that could have caused the fire. Of course, they had answers for each of those points. And the reason they did is because Willingham set the house on fire. I mean, if you just get back to the real truth of what happened, Willingham poured lighter fluid on the floor, threw a match down, set the house on fire, and killed his kids. And you can't just abracadabra up some miracle solution to that.
Then came a surprise witness by the name of Johnny Everett Webb, who swore that while he and Todd Willingham had both been confined in the Navarro County Jail, Todd had confided that he had killed his children. Todd supposedly shared that sensitive information while talking to Webb through a food slot in their individual cells. It was a less-than-private portal for delivering such monumental news to someone he had barely met, but you know the saying, criminals aren't the brightest bulbs. Prosecutor Jackson told the jury he had offered no incentive to Webb for his testimony. The only person who spoke to the character of, or in defense of, Todd Willingham, who had not been at the Willingham home on the day of the fire. The trial lasted less than 3 days. Deliberation took less than an hour. Willingham was found guilty of murdering his children. During the sentencing phase of the trial, two medical experts labeled Todd a sociopath. One of those men, a frequent prosecution witness named James Grigson, predicted that Todd would kill again. This, despite the fact that Grigson had never met nor examined Willingham. Small note here, 3 years after the trial, the American Psychiatric Association and the Texas Society of Psychiatric Physicians expelled Grigson from their ranks for his too often practice of prediction with 100% accuracy, future criminal behavior, and for diagnosing patients without ever speaking to them. The other expert to speak to Todd's personality disorder was Tim Gregory, a local psychologist who specialized in marriage and family counseling and who had, on occasion, hunted with Prosecutor Jackson. Dr. Gregory made much of the Iron Maiden poster, noting its violent death imagery. A Led Zeppelin poster also hanging on the primary bedroom's walls gave off similar vibes. The expert said, quote, "It reminds me of something like hell," end quote. The convicted man put his less-than-enthused counsel in charge of his requisite appeals while he hoped to be exonerated for something he continued to say he had not done. Then fate took a stab at intervening. A history teacher in Houston was approached at her church about taking part in a protest against the death penalty. She traveled to attend it. On the way back, a friend asked her if she might want to correspond with an inmate on death row. And so Elizabeth Gilbert, not the journalist, but another one, picked up her pen and wrote to inmate number 999-401, who was lying low somewhere in the Texas prison system. Todd Willingham wrote back, respectful and grateful for her desire to be his friend. He didn't have many. His cellmates were vicious killers. His father and stepmother were allowed visits only once a month. His wife, Stacy, had divorced him shortly after his conviction and was not interested in reliving that part of her life. However, she still maintained her belief in his innocence.
He was mean to me, but I always said, you know, he may beat me, he may kill me, but he would never do it to the kids. And I always knew that, you know. They were his kids. He never hurt the kids, you know. I mean... But me, that was a whole different story.
So there was no love lost there. She moved on. So Miss Gilbert's entrance into Todd's life was more than welcome. And the more letters they exchanged, the more Gilbert thought she ought to talk to some people to see where the truth lay. Because to her, he sure didn't seem like the kind of man who would kill his kids. She went to Huntsville to meet Todd. She went to Corsicana to read the trial testimony. She managed to get Johnny Webb, he was serving 15 years in prison at the time, to talk to her about his statement that Todd had confessed. She pressed him hard, but Webb stood by his testimony. Within a few months, though, the surprise witness sent a letter to Prosecutor John Jackson's office with a formal recantation of his testimony. Then he filed a recantation of his recantation. Needless to say, Webb was not a reliable guy. Later, he was determined to be mentally ill. Gilbert pushed even harder now to unravel what had happened. It was through that doggedness that she found Todd Willingham had lied to police. He confessed to her that, aside from breaking a window, he had never tried to go back into the house to rescue his children. Why had he lied? Gilbert tried to parse that question. So had some of his oldest friends. Here's Sherry Cooley from Ardmore.
And he said, "What I'm guilty of is being a coward." He said, "I should have died in the house with my kids." But he said, "It doesn't matter what people say. You can't let yourself catch on fire without trying to get away. And you can sit and say every day, I would burn up before I let my kids die in a fire." He says, "Not humanly possible."
I don't know about that, and I hope to never find out myself. Regardless, though, Todd admitted he had not tried. Police said they knew this already because they saw his bare feet weren't burned by the fire he had started. But their logic is a bit flawed. They assumed he had poured accelerant on the floor. If he had done that and then set the place ablaze, the floor would have been the first place to burn. They never considered that his unmarred feet might have been a sign that he had not set the fire. Fires, for the most part, burn upward until, say, the flames reach an obstacle to restrict their movement, like a ceiling. If the fire had been the result of an electrical short, and most of the electrical in the Willingham house had been exposed pre-fire, the floor would have been cool, and it would have been the last thing to burn. But he now said that he had never re-entered the house, so his feet were a testament to nothing. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by ButcherBox. Last year, we didn't grill at all, but this year, we're doing it.
That sounds ominous.
Well, grill season kind of makes me feel exposed. You can have the nicest grill, all the gear, but if the meat isn't great, people notice.
Yeah, there's nowhere to hide on a grill.
Exactly, which is why ButcherBox is so great. You know when you light up that grill, you're starting with good quality meat.
And you can taste the difference. The burgers, the chicken, it's just better.
It really is. ButcherBox delivers over 100 premium protein options straight to your door every Everything from grass-fed beef to wild-caught seafood.
And it's not random. You actually pick what you want. And everything is responsibly sourced. No antibiotics, no added hormones, no fillers. Just clean, reliable protein, which makes grilling a lot less stressful.
As an exclusive offer, new listeners can get their choice between free sirloin tips, ground beef, or chicken wings in every box for life, plus $20 off when you go to butcherbox.com/COTC. That's right, your choice of free sirloin tips, ground beef, or chicken wings in every box for life, plus $20 off your first box and free shipping always. That's butcherbox.com/COTC. Don't forget to use our link so they know we sent you. Forensic science has been around a lot longer than CSI would have you believe. Back in 13th century China, a magistrate solved a stabbing murder with a trick that would make any detective proud. He had every villager in town lay their sickle on the ground, and he waited. Blowflies, drawn to the invisible traces of blood and tissue still clinging to one blade, gave the killer away. The owner confessed. A Ever since then, the field has steadily grown, with autopsies and bullet analyses and toxicology, which emerged in the early 1800s when scientists first figured out how to detect poison in a body. If you've listened to the show much, you'll know how big a deal that was. Then came fingerprinting in the late 1800s, followed by DNA last century. Now, forensic science can be quite precise in some cases, what with the present-day use of genetic genealogy to figure out who done it. But there is still quite a bit of junk science out there, science that isn't science, but some kind of combination of conjecture and ego that passes for expertise. Many investigators in the past have agreed that they relied on their guts and what they consider common sense about how fires behave. They view it as an art, not a science. And yet they still consider their findings infallible. Fire science and its partner in crime, arson science, has been especially plagued by a lack of rigor when it comes to sound scientific principles. It has, in the words of many, been ruled by folklore. Here's fire scientist Gerald Hurst.
The problem with the training was that a typical fire investigator learned no science whatsoever, but he learned an art that had been handed down from fire investigator to fire investigator, and it was all based on a trust me basis. The guy I learned from taught me this, I'm passing it on to you.
It was not until 1992, 2 months after the Willingham fire, that the Guide for Fire and Explosion Investigations was published to assist those investigating possible arsons. If it had been followed to the letter in this case, the evidence produced to prove arson would have actually done the opposite. What was believed by most investigators to be the telltale signs of the application of accelerants and burn patterns and floor charring, glass crazing, and alligatoring hadn't been tested much in lab settings. And when they were tested, they couldn't be replicated. But that didn't stop most, if not all, investigators from testifying in court that these hunches were founding principles of arson investigation, backed up by what they told jurors was hard and fast proof. At the time, it should be noted that there was no requirement or certification, no training or schooling necessary to testify as an expert witness on fire causation. Today, courts require that an expert witness must demonstrate specialized knowledge beyond that of a layperson, and that the methods used to reach any conclusion must be evidence-based, per NFPA 921. But in the late summer of 1992, when Todd Willingham stood mute before the court, nobody asked Vasquez or Fogg on what grounds they had based their conclusions. They called themselves experts, and that was enough. In Willingham's case, the low burn patterns and the V patterns on the walls were interpreted by the assistant chief and deputy fire marshal as the location of multiple ignition sites. According to Rachel Diosavia, a forensic researcher at Australia's Griffith University, writing in Forensic Science Reform, Vasquez and Fogg, quote, also testified that charred wood on the base of a screen door, alligatoring of floorboards, melted bed springs and spiderweb patterns on glass windows, known as crazed glass, indicated that the fire burned hotter than would be a naturally occurring fire. End quote. Was that even true? No, it was not. But Willingham and his new prison pen pal turned friend, Elizabeth Gilbert, were not arson scientists. In all the years that Gilbert had spent with Willingham's case, she had not thought to ask real scientists in the developing field of arson science to look at the evidence and the testimony and see if someone had made a mistake. For that matter, neither had his original court-appointed counsel, which was replaced in 1996 by Walter Reeves, a post-conviction relief attorney who could see how little legal assistance had been given Todd since the day he was arrested. Reeves knew that a veritable revolution in arson science had occurred in the dozen years since Willingham had been convicted. He filed a writ of habeas corpus, a procedural effort that, without fresh resources to hunt down new leads and drum up some exculpatory evidence, was perfunctory at best. That writ was denied by the State Court of Criminal Appeals in late fall of 1997. In 2002, a federal district court of appeals followed suit. In December 2003, the U.S. Supreme Court declined to hear Willingham's case. His death date was officially set for February 17, 2004, at 6 p.m. He waited to see if Governor Rick Perry would grant him a pardon based on the new fire science work. Here's Reeves talking to the producers of Incendiary.
I remember sending him all the material and him getting back with me and telling me this is, basically it's just a bunch of crap.
Time was running out, and Walter Reeves was throwing Hail Marys everywhere. He found that the preeminent arson scientist in the world lived close by, right in Austin. Reeves sent the fire report, the trial testimony, and a plea to Gerald Hurst in early January 2004. Reeves made Hurst aware of the approaching deadline. Hurst was a renowned chemist who got his doctorate from Cambridge University and who had, in his younger years, developed military-grade explosives, something called bomb astrolite, as well as, not kidding here, the Mylar balloon. From the latter, he made enough money to retire. He thought it was time to turn away from destruction. He turned his attention instead to the sad state of fire investigation. Hurst would later say he found so much inaccuracy and so much fairy tale that he offered his services free of charge to any convicted arsonist. Todd Willingham's savior had come at last. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Rula. May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and I feel like every year we get a lot better at talking about mental health.
But actually doing something about it is still harder than it should be.
Like, deciding you want to talk to someone is one thing. Finding a therapist who's available, takes your insurance, and is actually a good fit, that's where people get stuck.
And that's what Rula is trying to fix. Rula is a healthcare provider group that connects you with licensed therapists and psychiatrists who are in-network with your insurance.
Rula partners with over 120 insurance plans, and the average copay is about $15 per session, which makes it a lot more realistic for people to actually follow through.
And you're not just getting whoever's available. They match you with providers based on your needs, your preferences, so you're more likely to find someone who actually fits. And there aren't long wait lists. You can often get an appointment as soon as the next day.
So it removes a lot of the friction, and I think that's the key. If you're going to talk about mental health, we should also make it easier to take the next step. This Mental Health Awareness Month, don't just think about your mental health, actually take the step to take care of it. Visit rula.com/COTC to get started. That's rula.com/COTC. You deserve mental health care that works with you, not against your budget. Arson scientist Gerald Hurst moved fast. He saw that Deputy Fire Marshal Vasquez had told the jury that the fire on 11th Street in Corsicana had burned hot and fast because an accelerant had been applied to the floors. Hurst knew, through his own experiments, that wood and gas-fueled fires burn at approximately the same temperature. He also calculated the amount of accelerant that would have had to have been applied to account for every incidence of it that the two investigators had chronicled. It would have had to be gallons and gallons of flammable liquid. Investigators found no such containers on the property. The experts had also said the accelerant was responsible for the aluminum front door threshold to melt. Hurst said, nope. The melting point of aluminum is around 1200 degrees Fahrenheit. Fires like the one at the Willingham home likely reached 2000 degrees. Again, no accelerant necessary. The stains Fogg and Vasquez had said were evidence of fuel deposits could not be replicated. The splash of charcoal lighter fluid on the porch? Well, if anyone had looked, and Hurst did, at the pictures of the house taken before the fire, they would have seen that that's where the portable grill and a bottle of lighter fluid had been placed. It had apparently been moved post-fire. Hurst also noted that the accelerant the investigators blamed was that same lighter fluid, problem with that theory is that lighter fluid is a mid-range, slowly igniting distillate that does not burn like gasoline. In his words, it doesn't go whoosh. The so-called crazed glass, that's caused by cool water, like from a fire hose, being applied to superheated glass. Nope to the evidence from the V-shaped patterns of the wall. Nope to the pour puddles. And nope to the pentagram. Hearst looked at a map of the children's room. Then he read eyewitness descriptions of how all the windows in that room had blown out at once and how glass went flying, causing the fire inside to intensify.
The prosecutor in this case literally believed that the burn patterns on the floor were in the shape of a pentagram, like some satanic ritual. When you actually look at the burn pattern that they drew, and then you look at where the windows are, windows furnish ventilation to a fire. And all they were looking at is what we call ventilation patterns.
The fire, he explained, had at that point reached flashover. That's when, and I love this precise description, it's no longer a fire in a room, but a room on fire. Hearst looked to solve another mystery of what happened that day.
The question has been asked, why were Todd Willingham's feet not burned? And the answer to that question is quite simple. If no accelerant was poured on the floor would have been relatively cool until shortly after flashover occurred in the bedroom. The last part of him that would have gotten any burn would have been his feet.
Hearst then noted that, from the photos taken post-fire of the children's room, he could identify at least one electrical short. He was not saying that was the cause, but he was saying no one followed that short far enough into the wall to know if it was or wasn't.
Todd Willingham's case falls into that category where there is not one iota of evidence that the fire was arson. Not one iota.
Hearst had used science and his own and other people's controlled experimentation to show how fire behaves. Gerald Hearst filed his report on February 13th, 4 days before Willingham was due to die. The members of the Board of Pardons and Paroles say they read it. It's unclear if the governor did. Sometime in the days before, Todd's ex-wife, Stacy, came to see him. Todd asked if his ashes could be sprinkled near the graves of his three children. She told him no. Something in her had clearly changed since her earlier statements, insisting he might have hit her, but he would have never hurt the children. And so it was that on February 17th, Todd ate his last meal, which in those days he could order up special, and was led to the death chamber. The 11th-hour efforts to save his life had made no difference. The board unanimously rejected Reeves' petition on behalf of Willingham. The governor, likewise, had the ability to delay the execution by 30 days while additional information was sought. Perry's office called Reeves a few minutes before 6 on the 17th and said no stay was coming. The Texas Department of Criminal Justice's practice at the time was to allow 3 reporters to witness the death, specifically a reporter from the Associated Press, a reporter from the Huntsville Item, and a reporter from the city where the crime for which the person was being executed took place. Willingham's last words were reported differently by different media outlets. Most outlets reported only his opening remarks, the dignified declaration of innocence. Only Janet Jacobs of the Corsicana Daily Sun noted that his final words took a hard turn when he spotted Stacy in the witness gallery. What followed was not exactly a graceful exit. Fact-checking the actual words, Kent Scheidegger of the Crime and Consequences blog filed a Freedom of Information Act request of the prison, as he knew the corrections department would have made note of the last words. The agency complied with the full transcript. Please be advised, it contains some pretty tough language. Quote, "The only statement I want to make is that I am an innocent man convicted of a crime I did not commit. I have been persecuted for 12 years for something I did not do. From God's dust I came, and to dust I will return, So the earth shall become my throne. I gotta go, Road Dog. I love you, Gabby. I hope you rot in hell, bitch. I hope you fucking rot in hell, bitch. You bitch. I hope you fucking rot, cunt. That is it. End quote. Oh my. What exactly had happened during that visit a few days before the execution? Something dramatic, it would seem. Stacy would later claim he confessed to her in that meeting that he had set the fire on purpose. But I could find no evidence that she said as much at the time, and his final words make it hard to imagine they followed some clearing of his conscience. Regardless, whatever words the two exchanged would be a topic of considerable confusion in the coming years. On December 9th, 2004, the Chicago Tribune published a story written by Maurice Posley and Steve Mills. It asked the question, did Texas execute an innocent man? The story documented chapter and verse about how the state had refused to hear what four national arson experts had concluded after they had reviewed the last-minute evidence. The Tribune had handed all the accumulated documents to fire scientist John Lentini, author of Scientific Protocols for Fire Investigation, who then convened three more experts to dissect the case. Lentini and Hurst are heavily quoted in the piece, which created a stir in Texas and in the fire science world. In 2008, the Texas Forensic Science Commission hired Dr. Craig Beiler, a preeminent researcher in the field and a later president of the International Association for Fire Safety Science, to look into whether Willingham was innocent. Here's Lentini explaining what happened next to a special meeting of the National Institute of Justice.
The Forensic Science Commission was scheduled to hear testimony from Dr. Beiler on October 2nd. On September 30 of 09, the governor dismissed three members of the Forensic Science Commission. Just routine, don't you know. Wasn't a cover-up or anything. There were editorials in the New York Times and the LA Times and Chicago Tribune. It got a lot of publicity. I think Governor Perry was hoping things would quiet down, but it made it very loud for a while.
The piling on began. The Innocence Project found seven different investigators to condemn the arson evidence as bogus and proclaim that Texas had indeed killed an innocent man. Opinion pages throughout the nation weighed in. According to death penalty advocates, the worst possible thing could have happened. For as long as there was an argument against the death penalty, the overriding concern of many who opposed it had been that innocent men would be murdered by the state. It certainly looked like one had. But Texas, and some Texans, weren't yielding. When ABC's Nightline interviewed Prosecutor Jackson in 2009, reporter Terry Moran, who you'll hear in the next clip, asked if he had accepted that the fire evidence given at trial was unreliable.
Some of the evidence was certainly less credible than I would have liked to see.
And doesn't that give you pause at all about sending a man to death?
Not a man like Todd.
One small side note on Jackson. In a review of Jackson's correspondence in later years, the Innocence Project uncovered evidence that the prosecutor had indeed worked to get an early release from prison for Webb, the jailhouse informant who swore on the stand he'd been offered nothing in exchange for his testimony. The State Bar of Texas accused Jackson of making false statements to the Willingham jury when he said he had made no deal for Webb's testimony. A Navarro County jury did not agree. Corsicana, especially investigators Hensley and Fogg and Willingham's one-time acquaintances, was unprepared to see themselves as complicit in his execution. Here's bar owner and fundraiser Vicki Prater again.
I believe that Todd Willingham got exactly what he deserved the day they put him to death. And I don't believe that he didn't get a fair trial in this town. And I don't... It's really a shame we couldn't put him to death three times since he took three lives.
And here's Governor Perry, who in late 2010 spoke to Texas Tribune reporter Evan Smith.
It's been in front of the Supreme Court four times. You had the wife come down within the last week and stand up and say, this man told me that he murdered our children. You have the defender who wrote me a letter and said, this man killed his children. This is a monster who killed his children. I think it's pretty clear to most observers about what's going on that this is a political issue. I'm very comfortable that the science was
right.
good and that the justice dispense was good.
Right.
Less than a year after Willingham was put to death, the same experts that were asked to weigh in on his case had testified for the defense in a case that was on appeal in the Texas system. Ernest Ray Willis was on death row just 48 hours from being executed for the arson deaths of two women in Pecos County when a federal judge threw out his capital conviction. The judge found that there was, quote, strong reason to be concerned that Willis may actually be innocent, end quote. Willis's case bore some striking similarities to that of Todd Willingham. The ruling did not immediately exonerate Willis, but after careful consideration, the Texas Attorney General and the Pecos County prosecutor declined to retry him. He was released from prison in October 2004. When Todd's family tried to have him posthumously pardoned in 2012, Willis stood with them. Willingham's ex-wife, Stacy, did not. Despite having told the Chicago Tribune and the New Yorker after his death, we're talking 10 months and 5 years after, respectively, that he had never confessed to the crime, Stacy remembered it differently in 2010. On the morning of October 6th, before a hearing was set to begin in Austin, at which a judge had been asked to clear Willingham's name, she read a prepared statement to reporters outside the Travis County Courthouse.
I'm here to make sure that my daughter's voices are heard. Todd murdered Amber, Carmen, and Cameron. He burnt them. He admitted he burnt them to me, and he was convicted for his crime. That is the closest to justice that my daughters will ever get.
By the way, the judge overseeing the hearing that day, Judge Charlie Baird, actually wrote an 18-page opinion concluding Willingham was innocent in the weeks that followed, but it never became official. The Texas Third Court of Appeals halted the proceedings before he could file it, ruling that Baird had overstepped his authority. Todd had hoped for a Hail Mary that was thwarted at every turn, but he did get one thing he wanted. His parents told reporter Gran that they ignored Stacy's wishes and sprinkled his ashes on and near the graves of his children. This case has taken a circuitous route through justice and politics, through science and stubbornness, through life and death. Did Texas execute an innocent man? I don't know. I tend to believe the actual scientist with the most up-to-date information. I don't know if I believe the initial investigation was done without malice. I certainly don't believe he got good representation. I mean, here's defense attorney David Martin again.
If you want to feel sorry for somebody, Willingham got to lay on a gurney and get put to sleep before he died. The babies died the most horrible death you can imagine. And they died that way because Willingham set the house on fire because he was a psychopath. And sociopath.
30 years of crime reporting, including on some unquestionably guilty parties, people who confess to committing the worst crimes you can imagine, and I've never heard a defense lawyer speak so harshly about his client in public. I suspect it caught the documentary makers of Incendiary by surprise too, because here's the question they posed to Martin at its end.
Aside from the public record and all the evidence that's put on during trial, I mean, is there any other reason that you're so confident that the right decision was made in this case?
Well, there might be. Maybe attorney-client privilege prevents me from telling you.
Maybe so. Maybe Martin knows something the rest of us don't. Or maybe he got so tied up in the horror of the girls' deaths and his dislike of Todd Willingham to begin with, that he forgot his job is to fight on behalf of his client, no matter his personal feelings. And maybe he alludes to knowledge he doesn't have, so he can keep believing that he didn't need to try any harder. To report and write this episode, journalist Amy Wilson read the detailed investigative journalism done by David Gran of The New Yorker and Maurice Posley and Steve Mills of the Chicago Tribune. She also read the full Willingham case review in Forensic Science Reform, Protecting the Innocent, edited by Wendy J. Cohn and C. Michael Bowers. She also read Forensic Science Assessments, a quality and gap analysis as it pertained to the case. She read the reports done by the Innocence Project, the Texas Forensic Science Commission report of 2009, and various others that appeared in Fire Science publications. As a native Texan, she has also eaten her share of Collins Street fruitcake. Crimes of the Centuries is available early and ad-free through Grabbag Collab. Head to www.grabbagcollab.com for exclusive content related to this show and access to other series on our profit-sharing network. Unless noted in the citations, this case was researched and written by me, Amber Hunt, and produced by Henry Lavoie. Original music is by Bruce Hunt, Andrew Higley, and sometimes my child, Hunt Van Benskoten. Other music comes from Epidemic Sound. If you like the show, please help us out by rating and reviewing on Apple Podcasts. Also, tell your friends. For more information or to recommend a case, go to centuriespod.com. On Instagram, we're at centuriespod, and you can find us on the Crimes of the Centuries Facebook page.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.